Blog Talk Radio.
What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio, and tonight is October, Tuesday the 12th, 2021, and tonight is a very special night because we remember Lynn Stewart, a special call-in discussion on the anniversary of her birthday, which was October 8th. In addition, we have a very special return of our special guest, Don Fitz, dealing with some more excerpts on his book on the human health care. The ongoing revolution is forthcoming. Although Brother Don is with us, he has agreed and feels it appropriate to let us start off with our celebration of the life of a warrior. Brother Ralph, what's happening?
My brothers and sisters, what is happening? Well, let's begin with remembering what this program is. This program is about political prisoners, freeing them, wondering why they are political prisoners, and understanding the relationship between yesterday's political prisoners and today's political prisoner. And I'm thinking that today's outstanding or most notable political prisoner is Julian Assange. the whistleblower, the one who told us about what America was up to. And I'm thinking of our dear sister Lynn's words. And one of those words were, I am the canary in the coal mine. And what happens to me is an indication of what's going to happen to others who would dare speak truth to power. And the issues today, one of the things I heard on last night's television with right-wing pundits and politicians speaking of the possibility and the inevitability of civil war in America. And while we speak of our political prisoners and comparisons of yesterday's prisoners and today's prisoners, we've asked people who knew Lynn to call in and give a few words so that others might understand what's going on. And I've decided that although I could give words as to who Lynn Stewart is, for there are some who call who are not familiar with who Lynn Stewart is, I think that we go right to Lynn Stewart herself and her words and what she thinks of what's happening. And it's as relevant today as it was many years ago. And as we always start our program, we start it with poetry in honor of Lynn Stewart. She often used poetry in her cases. And she often said, poetry is a form of speaking, of using words in a manner of no other form. And we have poets who begin our program with intelligence.
Hello?
And entertainment, yes, and learning. And our first poet this evening in honor of Lynn Stewart will be Nzinga. Would you begin the program this evening, Nzinga? Your microphone is open.
Okay, thank you. Good evening, everyone. Thank you again, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph, for inviting me, for having me on. It's always a pleasure. I learned so much and give me so much to think about. The poem I'm going to read tonight, it's not titled. It's just what I've been feeling lately. I've been listening to everything on this station and the news and everything else. It is harder and harder to express what I feel. I can't take another news story about an innocent child being killed. Deep down in my soul, I scream and I shout about the evil taking place day in and day out. Does anybody see the misery that these wolves in sheep's clothing keep impressing upon me? What with all their lies and their deceit, it's as if I'm in a game in which the only end is defeat. The real objective I know is to fight to the end, but sometimes I feel I'm in a battle I can't win. All of our leaders and true comrades taken, set up by the criminals and liars, run this vicious system that makes strong, powerful men out of powerless victims. Seems all I can do is continue the fight to honor our comrades who fought for the right to freedom, justice, and equality in a place where we know the just are not free, and there is little to no equality. But we must move forward with the agenda at hand to once and for all receive the rights we demand. Thank you, Brother Ralph and Sister Betty, for always having me here on the program. I am so honored every Tuesday to be a part of it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And I know I promised you that we will hear Lynn Stewart's words. And we're dealing with the intrigues of COVID-19.
Larry Pinkney, folks, few have not heard of the fiery, passionate, and yet gentle and well-reasoned legal defenses that Lynn Stewart, as a true people's lawyer, has provided for members of the Black Panther Party, the Black Liberation Army, the Weather Underground, the May 19th, Communist Organization, American Protesters, at the presence in New York of the U.S.-backed South African apartheid government's rugby team. Muslims unjustly targeted by U.S. authorities. And certainly neither last nor least for her enormously successful defense of black, of African-American Larry Davis against the racist police brutality of the New York City Police Department. And never far away, of course, was her husband, Ralph Poynter, providing Lynn with inspiration, crucial case research, and logistical data, which ensured the best and most effective legal defense possible for those who were being defended by Lynn. Ralph Poynter came out of a highly politicized black American family.
You hear it? No. I don't hear it either. I don't know what happened.
In New York City. And Ralph was there to greet Lynn and receive her home once she was released just days ago from prison. And we all have been fighting for that and demanding that. Joining us now, Lynn Stewart and her husband, Ralph Poynter. Lynn and Ralph, God bless you both. How are you?
Well, fine. It's easy to tell. I'm very well indeed. You know, the contrast to where I was a week ago and where I am now is just so remarkable. And so, I can't. There's no description for this.
Yeah.
You know, you go through a totally regulated miserable, loveless situation. And I come home.
Can you guys hear the recording?
My friends, my political community, and I am just so loved and so uplifted. You know, we could say I could use words for a half hour.
Well, that's wonderful, Greg. And Ralph, I know you're elated to have her home.
Let me tell you, as I once said, I'm better than I have been in 4 years.
Mm.
Diamond
and served in jail 49
months, I think.
Okay, hello. Can the audience hear us? We've been playing a recording by Lynn Stewart. Can you hear us?
My brothers and sisters, another technical difficulty. Can you hear now? Can anyone hear us out there?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. Like I said, this is the home of technical difficulties. And so we will not try to go back to the beginning, but I hope you heard me when I said you will hear the words of Lynn Stewart. I understand it was dead air, and we had voices. We had Lynn Stewart's voice on the radio. But what we will do now is we will go directly to a speech that Lynn Stewart made, and we're going to ask her daughter, Dr. Zenobia Brown, MD, MA in public health, physician, family medicine, hospice, palliative care, and with an MD from Columbia University, a local New Yorker. And we will cut out the space that we had had with an interview with Lynn Stewart. But Lynn Stewart did a closing of the Lawyers Guild in right after her arrest. It was in Minnesota around 2002. And so, Dr. Brown, would you read the speech that Lynn Stewart gave at the closing of the Lawyers Guild Convention in Minneapolis? Dr. Zenobia Brown, microphone is open.
Hey, good evening, everyone. And, you know, I want to thank you, Mr. Poynter, also known as Dad, for inviting me on the program to read Mom's work and her words that are and feel as poignant now as they did when she gave them in 2003 at the closing ceremony of the Lawyers Guild. And I hope that your listeners will stay with me as I try to get through this without, you know, all the emotion that comes through when we lose the greatest female lawyer warrior of our time. In the earlier part of my life, I worked as a children's librarian in Harlem. I was a storyteller. I still am happiest gathering the children, now grandchildren, together right before bed to read and tell stories. So powerful are these ancient tales from all the cultures of the world that one by one the adults will drift into or open the porch door or turn down the radio to hear better. And in thinking about what to say to you this morning as the closing words of this marvelous event, I'm reminded of the ancient nature of what came for, what we accomplished, and where we are going. For we are a gathering of the warriors of our day, those people who were placed on this earth at this time to change it. We were summoned here because tradition, ancient and modern, affirmed the strength doubled and tripled unto infinity by the collective will. And we saw that it truly works. We warriors came here to listen to each other, to enjoy each other, to exchange ideas, to remember battles of old, to plan. We also came here and we sang and we laughed a lot and we played poker and we watched the games of autumn, next year, Mets. And we hugged and hugged some more. We supped and dined and drank and toasted our heroes and derided, chided, hissed and booed our enemies. We learned. We have been inspired once again by the almost mystical and marvelous ability to gather strength through camaraderie, intellectual jousting, and exchange, but mostly by sharing the collective will to change the world. Today, some of us depart from the Twin Cities. Other warriors remain, but all on Monday will be transformed back to lawyers, activists, legal workers, students, and organizers. We leave here with quests to now be fulfilled on far-flung battlefields. I use these terms in the ancient and metaphoric sense, and I hope not to offend the peace activists. For we have formidable enemies, not unlike those in the tales of ancient days. There is a consummate evil that unleashes its dogs of war on the helpless. an enemy motivated only by insatiable greed. The miller's daughter made to spin gold. The fisherman's wife. Midas, all with no thought of consequences. In this enemy, there is no love of the land or the creatures that live there. No compassion for the people. This enemy will destroy the air we breathe and the water we drink as long as the dollars keep filling up their money boxes. We now resume our everyday lives, but we have been charged once again with and for our quests. And like Hippolyta and her Amazons, like David going forth to meet Goliath, like Beowulf the Dragon Slayer, like Queen Zenobia who made war on the Romans, like Sir Galahad seeking the Holy Grail. And modern heroes, dare I mention, Ho and Mao and Lenin, Fidel and Nelson Mandela and John Brown, Guevara, who reminds us, at the risk of seeming ridiculous, let me say that the true revolutionary is guided by great feeling of love. Our quest, like theirs, are to shake the very foundations of the continents. We go out to stop police brutality, to rescue the imprisoned, to change the rules for those who have never, ever been able to get to the starting line, much less run the race, because of color, physical condition, gender, mental impairment. We go forth to preserve the air and land and water and sky and all the beasts that crawl and fly. We go forth to safeguard the right to speak and write, to join, to learn, to rest safe at home, to be secure, fed, sheltered, loved and loving, to be at peace with one's identity. Until we meet again, our quests are formidable. We have in Washington a poisonous government that spreads its venom to the body politic in all corners of the globe. We have war, big war in Iraq, big war in Afghanistan, smaller wars in Colombia, Central Africa, Southeast Asia. We have detainees and political prisoners at home, and now looming in 2004, we have those Democratic and Republican conventions and then an election, with the corporate media ready to hype the results and drown out the righteous protests. But there are, in all of the towns and cities we return to, the people, our people, the day-in, day-out grassroots organizers, and they are busy. Coalition building, carrying out protests and actions against powers so vast and evil that our collective will must be to defend the people in this vanguard, to enable them to recruit and prepare fresh troops. And there are also individual quests. I hope and I believe that I will be in Birmingham next year, that our movement, our righteous movement, will defend me, and that our victory for the people, of the people, and by the people will restore the defenders, and this one in particular, to the front lines of the battle. So the long year 2004 stretches out again until we meet again. We have no crystal ball, but we have history, and that history teaches us. As we go forth, we learn from those who have struggled before us. A fellow traveler of an earlier time, a communist and a Jew, Bertolt Brecht, wrote his last poem, What Has Become My Credo, and I Give It to You. And I always thought, and I always thought, the very simplest words must be enough. When I say what things are like, everyone's heart must be torn to shreds. That you'll go down if you don't stand up for yourself. Surely you see that. Go forth and do justice.
Wow.
Well, thank you so much for that, Dr. Brown. And still, I've heard it so many times, and it is so relevant today, as relevant as it was when she spoke those words. And for those of you who didn't know Lynn Stewart, that's who Lynn Stewart was and is. And without further ado, I'm going to open up one of those warriors' phones that Lynn Stewart speaks of. Sarah Flounders, your microphone is open.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, and thank you, Dr. Zenobia Brown. Thank you, Ralph. Thank you, Betty, for tonight. Thank you, Lynn, for tonight, to remember Lynn. And I want to take up, really, Lynn saw herself, saw all of us, as warriors, and that is an important way to see it, against the dogs of war, as she said. Now, I've just returned from Nicaragua, and there's a country that, for those of you who followed, were part of the movement in the 1980s, when literally tens and hundreds of thousands of people went to Nicaragua to build the Sandinista Revolution, which happened in 1979, were part of that process. And against the Contra forces that the U.S., the mercenaries, the U.S. pumped into Nicaragua, and the terrible forces in El Salvador and Guatemala and Honduras to keep in place the most reactionary governments and try to defeat the Sandinistas. That's a history we remember of the 80s. Finally, in 1990, and I just want to recap this history quick, the Sandinistas were forced out of power just after the invasion of Panama, when the U.S. announced, if you elect the Sandinistas again, all-out war will follow. The population backed down. The Sandinistas were out until 2007. And in those 17 years of right-wing, U.S.-supported government in Nicaragua, everything the Sandinistas had fought for was lost. The entire economy was reprivatized. Healthcare, education, social services, everything was handed over to the corporate elite and U.S. power. Now, the Sandinistas finally came back in 2007, and since that time, not a moment of peace. 3 years ago, we saw an all-out coup attempt, again with mercenaries, and an effort to overthrow the government, claiming it was a democratic choice. So we went to Nicaragua, a small delegation, just before elections, which are due to be held November 7th in Nicaragua. And the U.S. government is again announcing that they want free and fair elections. That's what they call it, as if they know such a thing. They've never had them anywhere, including here, ever. There's no free and fair elections here. So there's a new promise of intervention, and we wanted to see what was happening in Nicaragua now. We were deeply impressed at a country today under the Sandinistas where more than 60% of the whole budget goes for free, full health care and free education for all, and where there's finally full literacy. Now, this is why the U.S. is denouncing Nicaragua as a dictatorship. And so we were there to try to, again, remind the movement in the U.S. that we have a duty to defend Nicaragua, to stand up to the attacks and the onslaught that is being planned against them once again, and that the movement here has to respond against the dogs of war. So at any rate, I just got back last night. We are going to be doing reports. I thank you for everything that you do. And just to say, this is a time when one war doesn't end. They just move somewhere else with their troops, with their forces, and with their threats. And we still have a lot of work to do. So thank you for tonight. Thank you for, again, reminding us. And thank you for, let's be here with Lynn, with that combative spirit, which both of you and all of you keep alive. Thanks.
Thank you so much for that, Sarah Flounders, a true warrior in the war against injustice and the war for a better world. Next up, we have another warrior forum in front of us. Long-term resistor, Pam Africa. Pam, your mic is open.
Hey, on the move. Just had to get in here tonight in order to express my love, continued love, for this warrior woman and who left so many great examples of what a stand-up lawyer is and what a good comrade, good wife, good, you know, everything that, you know, Lynn is. One of my good memories of Lynn and was being at the airport when y'all came in after y'all had kicked the government's ass, and who didn't think that Lynn was going to come out, but the consistency of the people's love and the strength that you led, and you know, through this movement, and you know, to bring Lynn home, that was one of the things. And then being on a radio show when Chakwe Lumumba, and he became governor, mayor of Mississippi, and we were on a radio show, and that stand-up lawyer, that front-line lawyer as well, and, you know, Lynn was still in jail. He had just become the mayor, and the topic of the conversation turned quickly to Lynn, and while we was doing, you know, conversation. It's just how much people, you know, love her, and, you know, some people, no matter, you know, where they're at, titles don't change things. And, you know, I love Lynn. And here's Raza Khan. And also, he can say something real quick.
Hey, brother. How's everybody?
How are you? Yes, we're here.
I was just going through some old literature because we're having a Black Panther thing tomorrow. And I have the case of Lynn Stewart when she represented the blind sheikh, because they're going to talk about law then and now and lawyers then and now. And I have about 40 or 50 pamphlets that I intend to leave with them, because you can't really express or explain to people what a real lawyer is. So I'm going to let them read this write-up on concerning her. You know what I mean? This was October 8th, I'm getting ready to give you her birthday, 1939. Mm. No, but I think it was 2005 or something like that. But I give out pamphlets and booklets and stuff like that to show people what a real warrior, a real lawyer is supposed to be like. And she was a magnificent example. Here's Pam back.
Right. Just asking people to join us at the Mandela Conference in next week. This week, and the Million Women March, We Charge a Genocide, next week. I'm not feeling really too good, and I'm trying to think of what's it's two more. And events that we're going to be at, you know, doing work around Mumia. And this December the 9th, and we're going to be doing, you know, more work around Mumia. So please stay tuned. And I'm glad that our entire family is out of jail and on this side on the jail line, you know, still fighting. Long live the spirit of Lynn Washington. Ooh, Lynn Washington. Lynn Stewart. And thanks for having this program. And thanks for giving us the chance to speak about our love for Lynn.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time, because you are a long-range warrior in the fight you have led for the Africa family and for Mumia Abu-Jamal and all political prisoners. And talking about political prisoners, next up will be Brother Jihad Abdul-Mumit, the head of National Jericho.
Yes, Brother greetings, Jihad, everyone. Thank you, our comrade Ralph and Sister Betty, and for inviting me into this space. This is an honor, particularly on this auspicious occasion, to honor Sister Lynn. Yes, and the speech she gave, her daughter gave, it's like that needs to be published somewhere. It really does, you know. And Jericho will help make sure that happens if you need that resource, you know. As Zenobia read, that has to be published somewhere. That was profound. So, and people need to hear that, and they need to hear it over and over again. The love, the respect, the encouragement, the inspiration, the knowledge, the wisdom, the history, the experience, all of that is in there, and that's what Lynn embodied as an attorney, as a revolutionary, as a friend, as a comrade. And I just wanted the same this occasion last year just to bring forth, even when incarcerated, you know, down there in Carswell, Texas, that awful place, you know, even from behind the walls, getting the same type of encouragement, you know, the same type of motivation, the same type of kick ass to get going. Yeah. And Ralph, I could not find those two letters that Comrade Lynn wrote me, but just to bring back into the space again, you know, man, what's wrong with you, Jihad? I mean, that's how she kind of talked to me. You know, you better get the Muslims on the case. And we're still trying to get a lot of the Muslims on the case, you know. We bring with us, you know, rich African heritage and history through Islam, and Lynn was able to see that, you know, and to really be motivating on the front line like that. She was unique in the sense that she was able to bring in to the space and vision and strategies of our movement the legal aspects led by her political acumen. The legal aspects led by her political acumen and her understanding, you know, of history and the politics and the movement and what has to be done. So on October 22nd through the 25th, we have a tribunal. And really in the spirit of Lynn and those attorneys that put in their work in the front line, the vanguard line of our movement, we're going to once again bring the United States to the carpet and charging it with genocide. And we're going to do that in the spirit of Lynn and all those that came before us in doing this type of work. So with all due respect, you know, and love and admiration from the National Jericho Movement and from the spirit of Mandela, you know, we salute you, Lynn, and we love you, Sister Betty and Brother Ralph. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for giving us that presentation, and I have to smile when I remember Lynn on the inside, in the death camp, writing a letter to you, the head of Jericho, to get busy with the Muslim brothers and sisters, bring them into the fold to a greater extent. I have to smile about that because she was in there working, trying to get this movement going, and I thank you for that presentation. Next up,
you're
we
welcome,
have reporter Sister Dolores Cox. Thanks again, Jihad Abdul-Mumit, National Chair of the Jericho Movement. Dolores.
Thank you. Hi. I just want to say a few words about Lynn. I'm remembering New Year's Day 2014. It was when Lynn and Ralph arrived at LaGuardia Airport here in New York City. There were giant smiles on both of their faces, and so many of us supporters were there to greet and welcome Lynn home. I mean, lots of hugs and kisses and tears of joy and gifts. You know, it was the day after her compassionate medical release from the Fort Worth, Texas prison. Ralph found out about Lynn's release after his plane landed in Fort Worth to visit Lynn. And in the airport in New York when they arrived, Lynn told us that there ain't nothing like freedom. That's what she said, and she described her freedom and coming home as sunlight bursting on her. She said that just the day before, she was deep in the dungeons, adding that prisons are horrible and loveless places. Lynn repeatedly expressed her gratitude to us for the tremendous support that she received from the thousands of people in New York, the country, and worldwide. Lynn's 10-year sentence was reduced to 4 years that she had already served. The next day, after she got home, Noelle Hanrahan, I remember, Hanrahan of Prison Radio had arranged for Mamiya to speak to Lynn, but Lynn couldn't for fear of violating the terms of her probation, which she was just learning about. At the airport, Lynn urged us all to continue to take action to free all political prisoners, stating that we must fight on and resist because it makes life worth living. Lynn Stewart, the people's lawyer, woman warrior, courageous freedom fighter. Praise ain't they.
Lynn Stewart, hey, thank you so much for that, Dolores Cox.
Lynn Stewart, presente.
Next up we have the local, the New York Jericho leader, Ann Lamb, who does the work to free and support all political prisoners. Ann, your microphone is open.
Oh, thank you so much, Ralph, Sister Betty. Lynn was such an inspirational person. I can only aspire to be like Lynn. I try every day to be like Lynn. I can never be as smart as Lynn, but I can certainly be a warrior like her. So really miss her, and as we just said, Lynn Stewart presente. She'll always be in our hearts, and I'll always remember her. And one of the best ways to remember her, of course, is by continuing to do the work. So I just have a very brief update on Russell Maroon Schultz, who is currently, thanks to the efforts of his family and his legal team, in an outside hospital because he was really suffering. He was in a lot of pain. He wasn't even able to hold down water for a couple of days. And Teresa Schultz, his daughter, was speaking to Barbara Zella, the Jericho doctor, who has been for years. And she was saying to Teresa, that's really dangerous because it could mean he has another bowel blockage. You know, they can't be sitting on that. So in between Teresa, her sister Sharon, Brett Grody, the lawyer, and Barbara, who they wouldn't even speak to on the phone at the prison, but I'm sure they know who she is, you know. He was successfully moved to an outside hospital where he's hopefully getting somewhat better care. And in the meantime, we have been urging people to sign some letters in support of Maroon's medical transfer to hospice care, as they call it in Pennsylvania. This will be resubmitted on appeal to the Pennsylvania Court of Common Pleas on or about October 18th. And we expect the hearing to happen toward the end of the month or possibly the very beginning of November. We don't know if it's going to be the same judge, Judge Kait Scott, who heard it the first time. Most possibly it will be. So we have two letters going. They're up on thejerichomovement.com. They're up on jerichomovement.org. They're up on linktree.com/freemaroonnow. I'm sending out an email as we speak for people to sign on. There's two letters. One is a community letter of support, which has already been signed by some Nobel Peace laureates. And folk like that, and we are also encouraged to sign. And then there's also an interfaith letter that we are trying to get as many faith leaders as possible to sign on to. So people can do that. That would be great. And that would be in memory of Lynn. Do that in memory of Lynn today, because you know she would be one of the first people to be doing this and to be speaking and to be demanding that Maroon be released so that he can transition at home and not in a prison cell. So Lynn Stewart presente, and Lynn, we will try to live up to be the kind of person that you were and always will be.
You're here, Ann.
Thank you so much for that, Ann Lamb. And to continue supporting our political partners is Kazi Touré, the Boston Northeast President. Kazi,
hello.
Your microphone is open.
It's open. It's open. All power to the people, man. Happy birthday, Lynn. Man, it's been a really good program, Ralph. And, you know, you sent me thinking about, you know, Lynn Stewart, people's lawyer. Man, when she came on our case, when you and her and y'all was introduced to our case and fought with us for 5 years. I saw who Lynn was, you know, and I got to know Lynn, and I saw the work that she did afterwards. I mean, Bill trained a lot of people, the Gombiners and Kuby and all them other lawyers, but I don't know where they are now, you know. And thinking about, like, if Lynn was here now, these people would probably try to lock her up again, you know, because that's how much she fought for the people, man. You know, like, she'd be on this thing, you know, nonstop. And, you know, especially around the 6th, what happened up there on the 6th, you know, on January 6th.
Yes.
But it's pitiful, man. It's pitiful. This country. Knees burning down. The thought of somebody having to sign petitions to get somebody like Maroon out and Sundiata out, Matulu out, man, and Mumia. It's just ridiculous, man. Straight up. It's the worst country in the world, man. And, you know, we just need to keep fighting and burn this shit down to the ground. All power to people. Long live Lynn Stewart, and hope some other lawyers, man, step up and try to be like her. You know what I'm saying?
I understand perfectly.
Because they ain't stepping up and being like her. These lawyers out here, man, they scared.
Yeah, well, they see what happens, Julian. They see what happens to Lynn. They see what happens to Mumia. But they still have to, as the rest of us do, do our work.
I mean, look at. Lynn saw that and stepped up. It didn't stop her. You know what I'm saying?
It didn't stop her, man.
Inside and out. All power to people. Long live. I love Lynn Stewart. Long power. No.
Thank you so much, Kazi Torre.
On the move, and we'll see y'all down on Spirit of Mandela, man. On the move.
Next up, we have Henry Higgins. I'm here, good evening.
Good evening, sisters and brothers. I'd like to share with you a memorial that Lynn offered in response to Marilyn Buck. And this was written some years ago, around about 2010 or 2011. My memorial to Comrade Marilyn Buck. I, Lynn Stewart, behind the wall. It was a surprise irony that the day the federal government finally released Marilyn was the same day they sentenced me to 10 years as her federal replacement in exchange of prisoners. As if anyone could ever replace Marilyn, her great spirit in the face of adversity, how she invested her talent into her poetry and translation, the inspiration she was to her contemporaries, and also to those who now follow her in lives dedicated to struggle, her lawyers, both Sophia, Jill, Elijah, and well-remembered Susan Jordan, who labored on her behalf for years because that is the way we are, supposed to honor and serve our clients, especially the political ones. And I want to remark on Marilyn's political activist life. We oftentimes shy away from that arm of our movement that was and is proactive, self-defensive on behalf of defenseless communities, building an offensive, protective, revolutionary movement. Marilyn's role in her espousal of the goals of the Black Liberation Army, her exploits as a member of the group are legendary. At the time of the Brinks expropriation in 1981, she was badly wounded in the leg, but nonetheless remained true to the work and continued underground until her arrest and trial. I honor her for all that she has done. Like Lolita Lebrun, she was an indomitable woman dedicated to and loving struggle. On a personal note, I wish I had gotten to know her better. We were sporadic correspondents, but I never visited. I knew she understood where I needed to use my time and talent. I did attend her release parties in New York and tried to be at the Sparks Fly celebrations as often as possible, including this year by letter from jail. but the chance to sit with a bottle of wine and sit and talk all night about anything and everything never happened. I thought I had the luxury of time, not so for her or for me. Now we can remember, and we should remember her sacrifice in the cause of human freedom and decency every day in every way. Sleep sweetly, dear sister. We will finish your work. Marilyn Buck Placente.
Thank you so much for that, Henry Higgins. Lynn Stewart writing to Marilyn Buck. Next, we have another freed political prisoner, Jan Lahman, who will give us some of his history and his thoughts on Lynn Stewart. Jan, your microphone is open.
And I remember
in the whole writing a letter of condolence when Lynn passed. Good to hear from you, Jan.
Yes,
your mic is
open. It's my honor to be here and say a few words, listening to all that's been said for this almost hour now. I mean, Lynn Stewart, my friend, my attorney, my hero, my sister, my comrade. I mean, everything that's been said could be said, you know, 100 times plus, and it would still leave room to say more about her in every way. And one thing I would like to say, all the bravery and willingness to stand up regardless of the consequences, all that's so true. But I would just like to also say, in 1985, when we were in MCC New York, locked up, all my Ohio 7 United Freedom Front comrades, and, you know, we had, from time to time, we were able to bring more of our family down, and especially my son Ricky, at the time about 3 years old, and when he came to New York to see me, he would always stay with Lynn. He would always stay with Lynn. And even at that young tender age, he would say that Lynn was so nice and she always made him a certain kind of food. I remember now and how he enjoyed staying there. So, I mean, besides all the militancy and the brilliance of legal matters and so forth, there was also that deep, deep human factor and compassion that she brought to her work. And that was also always, of course, a basis for that work and willingness to take on whatever needed to be taken on and struggled through to the end. And so I just wanted to bring that out, and I'm so glad to be listening to all these words here today. And Brother Ralph and Sister Betty, you know, I salute you and all the people here tonight. And with that, let me turn it back over.
Thank you so much for that, Jan Lahman. And as we talk about political prisoners, you have made a great sacrifice. And it's time for us to sacrifice for political prisoners like yourself who have made a great sacrifice for all of the rest of us. And this program, organize a few people to honor you being like you. Thank you, Jan Lahman. Next up, use the microphone. Tom Syracuse.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. The legacy of Lynn Stewart will always live on. She, no matter how unpopular, she defended all those, regardless of their popularity. She believed in equal justice for all. And we all honor her. Today is Columbus Day. And here's an example of how history has been totally perverted. We are taught that Columbus discovered America, even though millions and millions of indigenous had been living here for thousands of years. He was sent across the Atlantic Ocean open up direct trade with the Far East. He had no idea that there was a continent in the way, and when he arrived in the Caribbean, he thought he was off the coast of India, and he called the people Indians, and and the area the West Indies. In any case, unfortunately, he is used as an example of the Italian American contribution to this country, and that is based upon a total ignorance of history. Just as African Americans are taking down the statues of Confederate generals that started a civil war in which more casualties took place than any other war in American history, and these rebels should not be honored, and their statues are being taken down. The statue of Columbus must be taken down here in New York City at Columbus Circle. Today should be renamed in remembrance of the indigenous population. When Columbus arrived in the Caribbean, he tried to enslave the indigenous living there, and if they resisted, he literally murdered them. Missionaries reported this to the Spanish government, and he was actually arrested and put in jail for a while. But the Spanish government wanted to organize new expeditions to the so-called New World, and so they released him because of his experience. In any case, I formed a committee of Italian Americans. I happen to be an Italian American take down the Columbus statue at Columbus Circle, to abolish Columbus Day. Italian Americans should have their own day like other groups, but they certainly shouldn't have picked this murderer who committed such as crimes as an example of their culture. Instead, they should have their own day in which the unification of Italy as a nation should be celebrated. People like Garibaldi and Mussini, who were instrumental in this unification, they're the ones that Italian Americans should look up to. And I formed a committee of Italian Americans last year, and I wrote to Mayor de Blasio, who, by the way, changed his name. He had a German, his father's family was of German descent, so he figured he'd get more votes if he changed his name to his mother's family, de Blasio. He was supposed to form a committee to consider this whole question of Columbus Day. He never did. But we must, just as the statue of Theodore Roosevelt is going to be taken down in front of the Museum of Natural History, anybody seeing that statue could see that this is an insult. Here you have Theodore Roosevelt on a horse, and you have two people standing next to him, looking up to him, one representing the indigenous people, and the other one's representing African people. That's that, finally, because of pressure, that statue will be taken down. And we must keep up the pressure to take down the statue of Columbus and dedicate today, October 12th, as Indigenous Peoples Day, and the Italians should be given their own day, and to have as an example of Italian unification and as a nation, someone like Garibaldi. Thank you. Thank you very much. I hope that we can we can build enough pressure, because unfortunately, people, most Americans, including Italians and other groups, they do not know the true history of their own, and also of the United States. And it is up to us to bring out this history. There are southern states now who want to delete references to the brutality of slavery and the genocide of Indians, claiming that this pits people against each other. Well, what really pits people against each other is not knowing what their history is. It's a capitalist system that pits people against each other to maintain itself and to maintain its imperialism over people of color in the rest of the world and here in the United States itself. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for that, Tom Syracuse. And he represents the concept that the work continues. And in the spirit of Lynn Stewart, we do this work. Next up, Joel Myers. And I say, get out your notebook, because Joel always has a presentation that should be taught in the course. Okay, Joel,
well,
your mic.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, it's such a, I feel so honored to be able to speak together with the other speakers and contributors to this program. It's a, and especially to come in, to come to it today in honor of Lynn Stewart on her birthday, ironically so close to the birthday of that infamous war criminal, Columbus, who's finally getting his posthumous justice in the sense of being regarded as the beginner of colonizing this area and the genocide on the continents from all the way up to the northern tips of Alaska and Canada, down to the Tierra del Fuego. He's the one that started this and gave the impetus for a world of racial slavery And this is the legacy that Lynn Stewart was fighting against all the time. Where does somebody begin to talk about the contributions of Lynn Stewart? We all know about legal cases that she took up, that she was one of the very few true lawyers. And in this, lawyers are the ones that you have to watch out for when they're defending you. You sort of know what the judge is going to do. You know what the prosecution is going to do. But it's very frequently your own lawyer that ends up stabbing you in the back. And there are only a handful of lawyers in this country that that really stand up for your defense in the name and the spirit of justice rather than law, which Lynn said law, I believe she said it this way, that law is whatever they say it is. They, meaning they with the capital T, the people who administer the law as a weapon of the ruling class to keep everybody else in place. Criminals in the country who have robbed the entire world, robbed it through murder and maintained it through perjury. This is what most lawyers are really defending, and Lynn Stewart stood away from that. She would not be one of those lawyers that just enforce the will of the biggest criminals against the selected victims who were made examples of because they didn't follow the rules of robbing and raping and pillaging the entire world, which we see going on all the time. The prison system is designed to keep people submitting class. And that's why Lynn, who as a lawyer, how many lawyers does this happen to, as a result of adequately defending the people that were targeted by the ruling class, was attacked by the media and set up and framed up and wound up in prison herself, where her death was contributed to by the poor medical care, if anything, and maybe even in other ways in terms of the origins of her cancer. They kill many people in many different ways, and Lynn was imprisoned, and her life shortened because she was standing up for justice rather than the law of the murderers, thieves, and perjurers that govern us. She started out, I believe, defending a William Holder who had hijacked a plane as an act of war, an act of self-defense of the people who were victimized around the world and who called attention to it in that way. And Lynn always took on the tough cases. She also took on the case of Larry Davis, who was framed up and set up, and she was able to get some of his reduced, although she wasn't able to free him. And of course, there was the case of the blind sheik, who was also framed up and set up because he was instrumental in bringing the truth to the people about what's happening in the Middle East and how we're all being manipulated into the rebirth of the anti-Muslim crusades, which the current struggles in the Middle East are a continuation of the Crusades that had sort of come to a truth in the 1400s and at the end of World War I began to come back to into flame because of the destabilization of the Middle East, the return of the first Crusaders, the British and the French especially at the time, and also the Balfour Declaration, which would lead to the settlement of 5 million people that were European oriented and sponsored by and into the Crusader state, which is blasphemously called Israel, and so that disrupted the equilibrium. And Lynn Stewart, that's what Lynn Stewart was up against, and that's why they went after her. They during the trial of the Blind Sheep, they enforced special administrative measures, a very exceptional thing, so that she was forbidden to address the public, to tell them the truth about what was going on in the frame-up of the Blind Sheep. And she stood out as somebody targeted, and somebody that would be targeted and eventually imprisoned by this criminal system, as one of the people who refused to take part in and collaborate with the criminals. As most lawyers do, as most lawyers, it has to be said, make it their profession. They'll take an innocent person and they'll make you think, they'll make the innocent person feel that they got a break because the lawyer was able to plead them guilty to something where they would get less than the maximum sentence that they were originally being set up for. Lynn Stewart didn't take that bait. Lynn Stewart didn't play that game. She was on the team of the people that are struggling for liberation around the world and who are attacked by the system. We have a recent case, by the way, of Stephen Bonsiger, another attorney who tried to bring justice against Chevron Oil. And we see that even the regular prosecutors wouldn't take the case. They recognized it was so dirty. And the judge went out to hire a prosecutor to do the case, Stephen Bonsiger. People should go to court whenever that case appears because it's a continuation. But Lynn was one of the people who came before that and who dramatically helped set the tradition of the revolutionary practice of law against the criminal system and to try to bring about a system on the earth that would be based the regular people, the working people, the people that create all the values, the people that create all the food that we eat, have the houses that we live in, and so on, rather than those that profiteer off of human life. She wanted a system based on justice, and she wanted justice for the fighters for that system and all of those who were opposed to that system from the standpoint both of the depredations of this system which robs the poor to feed the rich. Robin Hood in reverse, she was the one, really the leading person in the 20th century who took up that mantle in the position of what lawyers are supposed to do according to their oaths and according to the best traditions of using law to fight for justice. So Lynn Stewart, even though there were others who were doing similar things, is totally irreplaceable. and has really helped to change the world in a way that to some degree, when you look back at it, is almost unimaginable what she has accomplished, not only in legal victories and so on, but in changing the consciousness of the people in the United States and around the world. So that that's why a lot of these statues, like Columbus and so on, are coming down, because people are more aware of the injustices that the people of those statues are deifying falsely. People have that consciousness now where they won't take it anymore, and the war for justice around the world is coming to a head, as you can see from the reaction to the offer of COVID vaccines, how nobody trusts the government anymore. This is a totally unprecedented thing. And even when people are threatened with a disease, they know that criminals are running the government, that criminals are offering the cure, and people are resisting even giving up their jobs with all sections of the population. I read that even the police department of Seattle in bulk is being fired because they refused to take vaccine. And Lynn Stewart enabled people to see the injustice and the criminality of this system. And yes.
As I said, when you came on, people should get out their notebooks, because you have a wealth of information. And we appreciate what you've done, but we must move on. And when you were talking about around the world, we have Don Fitz waiting to make a presentation about Cuba and medicine in Cuba. Don, your microphone is open. Thank you so much, Joel.
Before we get open Don's mic, Gwen is waiting in the wings, and we have a special person who wants to say a few things, Muba. Gwen, your mic is open.
Hi, everybody. Almost everything I wanted to say has been said, especially to Joel. But I did not know Lynn personally. I met her just a few times, but I admired her from the time I saw her when I went to see her in Foley Square the night they took her away. When I saw her for the first time, I was surprised at how small she was, diminutive, very plain, and how she came out and she said, "Tonight they're taking me away." And instead of having bitterness in her voice and anger, justifiable anger, she had hope in her voice, because she said she's going to be with her sisters and she's going to continue the fight and the work. And I was so struck by this, because I don't think I've ever met another person who would have seen something like that and taken it in a way that she did. It was Christ-like to me. There are people in the world like this. There are prophets. And I think that Lynn was a very special person. I think that she had strength and she had humility. And I think that is what made her special. It was that balance, both things. She didn't have a gigantic ego. She didn't walk through the door, you know, telling you how great she was. She just kept her nose to the grindstone. She kept a very level head about her, and yet she was doing remarkable work. And Joel was right. It was work that affected all of us. And it affected, I'm sure, Stephen Donziger, who's in the same place that she is in now. And I think the saddest thing that happened was the precedent where we start putting lawyers in jail for doing their job, for being lawyers. And it seems to be getting more outrageous and more out of hand. The case of Donziger is, you know, a man who wins this unprecedented case with $6 billion for the indigenous people of Ecuador, after, you know, Chevron Oil dumped all that oil into their habitat. We were thinking we'd call this man a hero. Instead, he's been vilified. He's been locked up in his house under house arrest. He has our Justice Department didn't take it on. Well, that was a good thing, but the bad thing was the judge hired a prosecutor, and the prosecutor were the lawyers that worked for Chevron. Then the judge who was overseeing the case was a Trump appointee. I went down to see it, and even Coogee couldn't save this. He had some great lawyers. Nobody could save this man from this true evil. She wasn't going to do her job. She let you know, I'm on the side of evil. I'm marching with it, and I'm going to get ahead and just keep grinding this man down. And so it frightens me that we're going to end up with so few lawyers that want to take on any righteous work because the price is so high to pay. And I truly think Lynn lost her life due to the fact that they put her in prison. I'm sure that she lost her life because of that. And I'm sure that this man, his life is hell. And so I think that, you know, political prisoners, it's going to get worse and worse. I also just want to say, I wonder how she would feel today about so many people being discriminated against who will not take a vaccine that has things in it that we have no idea of how they're going to affect the body. And I wonder if she would feel that it was right to tell people they could not go to work or that they should be shunned on the radio and called names. These are people that I've walked with and I've worked with, and I'm very upset that people that are so aware. Tonight we have listened from the beginning of the show up till now about the stacks of atrocities that the United States government has perpetrated against itself and the world, its own people and the world. And so I just find it breathtaking to hear people on the left that speak so cavalier about sticking something into your arm when you really don't know what it is and you don't know what the effects are going to be, because this government, which has been so untrustworthy in the past, all of a sudden is doing a great thing by cooking up this brew and telling people to stick it in their arms and not even know what the actual outcomes will be 5 years from now. I wonder what she would think about that, because to me, it's unconstitutional that people should be forced against their will to have to take something like that or lose their job, or lose their insurance, or not be able to be treated at hospitals when they go in to get treated. I think this is an atrocity, and I really think that it's a shame that so many on the left are walking in lockstep with the government that they must know by now you simply cannot trust. You really need to take another look at this. So I'll leave it there, and I thank you for listening.
Well, thank you so much for that, Gwen, and I'm sure there are people who agree with your sentiment, and one day we will discuss the issue 19.
We want to go on, and before we go to Don, we have one more speaker, Sister Muba Yarafulani. She's an advocate for education, especially she is anti-mayoral
everything.
Control, pro-community control, and she is of schools, and she is right now fighting a battle to keep our African burial ground on Bedford and Church Avenue free of real estate interest. Sister Muba, thank you for joining this special broadcast. Before we go to Brother Don Fitz, all of you who are on the call, you know we're going to deal with this whole issue of medicine and Cuba, what medicine and healthcare should look like. But just before that, Sister Muba, your mic is open, and we are so honored to have you.
Thank you so much, Betty and Ralph, for this opportunity on this special evening where we honor and remember our beloved Sister Lynn. You know, there is a saying, each time our ancestor says, each time you call the person who have traveled on to the other life, they are still in the living with us. And that's something we must remember, always to call our ancestors' name so they will continue living with us. Lynn, our sister Lynn, who is now on the shoulders of our great ancestors, looking down upon us and guiding us as we move forward in this struggle. in so many different areas. Every day we get up is one struggle or another. But we have our ancestors here with us as we move forward. They have tried. The white supremacy have tried to get rid of us as a race, but it cannot take place because without us, there is no them. So therefore, I take this evening to say we will continue having Sister Lynn in our hearts, in our midst. I remember the few times I met her. I actually went to Manhattan when she had just come out of prison, and she met at the Freedom Social Party. I think it's on 123rd, if I'm not mistaken. And I went there several times to hear her speak. Such a humble way, powerful and humble. I call her a humble giant. That is how I looked at her when I heard her speak at some of the forums where I attended. But again, she's with us. That is the wonderful thing. The spirit never dies. And we will have her with us as long as we are good spirits with her. So, you know, I just recognize her this evening, and I honor you all for letting us have, all of us, have this privilege to acknowledge how Sister Lynn can have lived with us on the earth. But with that said, and yes, Sister Betty, my passion is about education, and the miseducational system that exists today does not show a good future for our young people. And we know our young people are the future. They are the ones who are going to do everything for the seniors when that time comes. So if they don't get the right education, they will be all lost. And yes, that my passion is that I do believe no one person should have control of any system. Mostly the educational system. No one person should have that decision. And what is even worse to this whole miseducational system, parental involvement. They are not allowing parents the freedom to be in the decision making for our children, our future. And that is a big, big disgrace and disrespect to parents and guardians and grandparents out here in this New York City. Our children are in big trouble. And if we do not advocate for them, we who know better, we have to do better. And that's why I'm out here, not just for education, as Betty stated. I am out here to fight for righteousness wherever I can put my hand and feet in. So again, thank you so much for this program. It's a powerful program. It's a more needed program. And I am here in whichever way to support and be there to work with you all as you go forward. So I thank you for this opportunity. And everyone, have a restful night.
And thank you so much for that. And thank you, Don, for being so patient. And now your mic is open. We would love to hear your report.
Again, we want to say this is the title of his book is Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution is Forthcoming.
Your mic is open. Your mic is open. Hello? Don Fitz, your mic is open.
Oh, I think I have the wrong mic open.
Can you hear me now, Ralph and Betty?
Yes. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we do. And thank you
okay,
for
fantastic.
Your
fantastic. Okay. I've been on, but I guess our connection was bad for some reason. I wanted to thank both Ralph and Betty for inviting me to be on. I think it's a true honor to be on a show that gives so much information about Lynn Stewart and people's personal relationships with her. Before this program, I knew very little about her except that she'd been a lawyer. And so it has really been educational for me, and I want to thank everybody for helping give me an education. The person who talked about not trusting lawyers and how Lynn Stewart was above the other lawyers because she really knew what she was doing made me think of what happened to me in 1969 at the height of the Vietnam War when I was arrested for a demonstration that opposed the war. And I had a lawyer who I was sort of a little bit skeptical of, but then during the trial, the lawyer forgot to bring up what we had agreed he would bring up during the final statement, during the wrap-up statement at the end. And as a result, I spent 3 months in jail. So, yes, you do have to watch your own lawyers. And had I had somebody like Lynn Stewart, that probably would not have happened to me. Okay, let's get on to Cuba. When did Cuba start preparing for COVID? I would put the date as January 1st, 1959. That was the date of the revolution over 60 years prior to the onset of COVID. And I choose that date because that was the date that Cuba decided to totally change its medical system. And before, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that there had been a discussion, a fierce discussion within the medical associations in Cuba long before 1959, for 15 or 20 years, with some doctors thinking what they needed to do was to get rich, and other doctors thinking what was super important was to go to the community, especially the poor areas, the blacker areas, and the rural areas. Those tended to go together. Cuba became dedicated to redesigning their entire medical system, which it took them about 30 years to do. They didn't just do the same thing as what had happened under capitalism. They redesigned it and then redesigned it and redesigned it again. While they were doing that, they were doing incredible amounts of research. They worked on eliminating polio by vaccinating the entire population by 1962. They eliminated malaria by 1967. They eliminated neonatal tetanus in 1972, diphtheria in 1979, congenital rubella syndrome in 1989, post-mumps meningitis in 1989, measles in 1993 and 95, and then they developed vaccination for tuberculosis meningitis in 1997. So Cuba was doing this all throughout the revolutionary period. A time that really hit Cuba hard was began in 1990 because at the end of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s, two things happened simultaneously that really hit it. Cuba had been in Angola, defending Angola from the right wing and especially from South Africa, and as a result of that intervention in Angola, The South African revolutionaries became even more emboldened and ended apartheid in South Africa. But what happened right when the Cuban soldiers were coming home was the first AIDS, if you think back to the AIDS epidemic, it was 1986 when Cuba had their first patient die from AIDS. So they did not know what it was. Nobody in the world knew what it was. So Cuba started to quarantine everybody who had AIDS. And the United States immediately started a hate campaign that accused Cuba of being hateful towards homosexuals because they were quarantining people with AIDS. And this ignored the reality of what was happening. First of all, the majority of people in the early stages who had AIDS and who were quarantined were heterosexuals. They had just been to the war in Angola. And if you know anything about the first stages of AIDS, you know that in Africa, where AIDS spread very widely, it was predominantly a heterosexual disease. Cuba had also quarantined people before about different issues, dengue, and nobody thought it. The United States never went to a campaign about that. And also, at the same time the U.S. was condemning Cuba for quarantining patients, the United States had its own episodes of quarantine. As Cuba was starting to get over that, then the Soviet Union fell in December of 1991, and the $5 billion they got from the Soviet Union totally collapsed, and this exacerbated the AIDS problem because the embargo that the United States had set up, where countries were not supposed to trade with Cuba, meant that Cuba did not have drugs at the same at the rate that it needed to. And so one of the things that Cuba felt that it was forced to do, it did not want to do, it wanted to, it started to open the gates of tourism and said everybody can be a tourist in Cuba. I mean, you know, people come to Cuba. And this was, it was something because they did because the country was economically ruined, and, but it, they knew that tourism would open the gate to prostitution, which happened. And so prostitution by the early 1990s was one of the best ways to spread AIDS, or worst ways. And so Cuba was so stressed by what was happening by 1992 and 1993 that it cut back in every area of what people, what money was being spent on, food, housing, everything. There's only two things that were left that was not cut back on, and that was education and medical care, because Cuba has always been dedicated to medical care. So they went into high gear working on everything they could to develop tests for AIDS because the United States and the rich countries would not help Cuba. And so Cuba was very successful at developing its own methods to cope with AIDS. And by the 1990s, it had changed in Cuba, and now AIDS was predominantly a homosexual. It was more a disease associated with homosexuality than it had been 7 and 8 years earlier. And so Cuba, again, went into high gear for an education about people not to be scared of homosexuality, to accept homosexuality as a fact of life. It provided condoms free at doctors' offices, and it educated people about how to take care of themselves much better than the U.S. was educating people. And so what happened in the early 1990s was the Torricelli Bill of 1992 and the Helms-Burton Act of 1996, and they were specifically designed, as the author said, to wreak havoc on the island. And they by telling in strengthening the embargo and prohibiting countries from bringing things into Cuba, it made it very difficult for Cuba to get the diseases that that it needed to fight AIDS. But Cuba was so successful at education campaigns about localizing the understanding of AIDS, localizing how it spread and what to do. At the same time that New York City had about 43,000 cases, Cuba had 200 cases. And Cuba and New York City have about the same population. And by 1997, there was an article in The Lancet, which is one of the best medical publications in Great Britain. And it said, quote, it said Cuba, quote, had the most successful national AIDS campaign in the world. Even though it had only a small fraction of the wealth of the U.S., Cuba actually did much better than the U.S. in controlling AIDS. And so what happened, the special period is roughly from 1990 or 1991 through 2000, a 9 to 10 year period. At the beginning of that period, during that period, things changed a lot in contrast between the Cuba and the United States medical systems. Cuba began having a lower life expectancy than the U.S., by 2000, Cuba had a higher life expectancy than the U.S. Cuba, in 1990, Cuba had a higher infant mortality rate than the U.S. in that switch during the special period. And at the end, Cuba had a lower infant mortality rate. And then AIDS, as I just mentioned, Cuba had a much lower rate of AIDS. So this showed that Cuba, even through the economic hardship, it showed that a poor country could do an enormous amount for taking care of its people if it devoted the money to the right ways. One of the things that happens all throughout Cuban history is that they have outbreaks of dengue fever. And dengue is it's a mosquito-borne illness that is very devastating for the countries that suffer from it. So what happened during the dengue outbreaks in the 1990s and actually before that is that Cuba had medical students from the Latin American School of Medicine. Now, keep in mind that these students come from 100 different countries. So they're from all over the world. So they learn how to speak Spanish, but they have all sorts of different accents. One of the things they did when they were during the dengue outbreaks is that they would go door-to-door to people to look at their homes to see if they had plants growing that encouraged mosquito breeding, if they had standing water that encouraged mosquito breeding. And they had 100% compliance of people saying, yeah, you can go into our home and look it over. Just try to imagine in your mind what would happen if the United States had a disease outbreak and the government wanted to go into everybody's home and look at it. It would be these Trump fanatics would go berserk. But in Cuba, it's universally accepted that the government does a good job of medical care, and nothing is going to happen to people if all they do is cover their water so that it, a cistern, you know, gets the rainwater so that it doesn't breed mosquitoes, and they don't have things going on inside their house or garbage outside the house, anything that encourages mosquitoes. During that time, Cuba its research institutes developed a medicine called interferon alpha-2b, which was very good at treating the dengue. And what it does, it's not a vaccine, and it doesn't cure the disease. It strengthens cells so that they can fight a virus better. And it's been used since then for many other diseases. If we go forward to 2014, you might remember the Ebola outbreak in sub-Saharan Africa. And at the time, people were terrified that Ebola would spread everywhere. And there were 20,000 people affected with Ebola in Africa, and 8,000 died. Now, compare that to the current coronavirus. You know, you have a tiny proportion of people dying who get COVID-19, but you had a huge number of people dying from the Ebola virus. Nevertheless, Cuba, the country that was worst affected in Africa was Sierra Leone, and the United States sent military support. Now, what value military support had for fighting the virus is utterly beyond me. Other countries sent money. Cuba was the only country that sent doctors. It had already had international medical brigades going to other parts of Africa and Latin America. And so it sent 4,000 medical staff, including 2,400 doctors, to Sierra Leone. And what did they do? They trained doctors there and throughout Africa and Latin America how to deal with Ebola without getting sick yourself, without infecting yourself. And they taught 13,000 Africans, 66,000 Latin Americans, and over 600 Caribbeans how to effectively treat AIDS. If you remember the first days of the coronavirus a year and a half ago, in the very first days of the revolution, there was insufficient medical staff in rural Cuba, so they had to both redesign the medical system and send their doctors to rural areas to make sure that everybody was treated. And so once they started to have medicine all throughout Cuba, they started to send their doctors all over the world. There have been huge numbers of Cuban doctors going everywhere. And the sort of work that they did was like in Venezuela and Brazil, they could not find enough of their doctors to go to dangerous places, because in those countries there's a lot of places where doctors simply won't go because they don't have any protection. But it's very hard to reach them. And Cuba went to the most dangerous areas, even when they had to travel by donkey or canoe. They went to where the doctors there would not go. When Cuban doctors went to Bolivia, they went to areas that were so remote that the name of the town didn't even appear on a map. 11 years ago, a devastating earthquake hit Haiti. And the news in the United States showed doctors from the U.S. going to Haiti, but did not show Cuban doctors going there. United States doctors basically went to stay, and they went to serve people during the day, to give medical care during the day. In the night, they went back to luxurious hotels. Helicopters took them back to the luxury hotels every night. Cuban doctors live and work with the people in Haiti. Cuban doctors were there in Haiti before the earthquake hit, and they stayed after the effects of the earthquake were over, because they had a cholera outbreak, which was horrible, and the U.S. was long gone when the cholera outbreak hit. So,
Don, could I ask you, what is your opinion of where the cholera outbreak came from in Haiti?
It was very clear. People were in refugee camps, and they did not have decent sanitation facilities. And so the cholera outbreak came from drinking contaminated water. You either drank contaminated water, or you didn't have any water to drink. And then Cuba was very, when they were there, they were able to teach people very quickly how to deal with cholera, how to separate water into good drinking water and water that was contaminated. And so Cuba was able to do excellent work in controlling the cholera outbreak. And by this time, by the turn of the century, Cuba had, there were about 2 million people in the world who owed their lives to Cuban doctors. And if you remember Hurricane Katrina in 2005, for people in New Orleans were homeless, were suffering disease. Cuba had 1,586 healthcare professionals with their bags ready to go to New Orleans, and George W. Bush said, no, we don't want people to go there. We don't want to accept Cuban doctors. And so he's basically saying he would rather low-income people in New Orleans die than to admit that Cuba could treat them better than the U.S. could not take care of its own citizens. One of the things that happened throughout Cuban history is that Cuba always, ever since the revolution, Cuban people have trusted the medical system. And I talked to one woman in particular who would fly back and forth to Cuba. I met her in an airport, and she didn't like Castro, and she didn't like the communist system. I said, oh, well, what do you think about the medical system? And she said, oh, the medical system's great. I go back home to get treated all the time. And so even people who don't like the revolution trust the medical system. That is something which is critical, important in explaining what's happening in people's reactions to COVID in Cuba and the United States. In the United States, as other people have said tonight, people do not trust the government, to be honest. In Cuba, ever since the revolution, people have trusted the government, and they've worked with the government, and the medical institutions are actually under control of the people. One issue that is very important is that no one in Cuba has medical insurance. There's no such thing as medical insurance. Medical care is a right as a human being. This is extremely important for understanding Cuba. One thing about the United States that I want to mention is that Joe Biden has said that he would veto any Medicare for All bill that comes to the House of Representatives.
Medical care as a right, it's very subversive here in America. Excuse me for interrupting, but to remind people that as Joe Biden had said before he was elected, if elected, and a national medical care bill came before him, he would not sign it. We have to understand what this American democracy really is and what the American Democratic Party really is. But excuse me.
One of the things which is really important, even the Medicare for All bill is just a starting point. It's not an end point. It's not a resolution to the problem. Because what it would guarantee you is insurance and insurance coverage. And we should never forget that what we should be demanding is not insurance for all, it's medical care for all. And the Democrats, the Democrats differ from the Republicans only when they say that more people should have medical insurance. They want to keep the insurance companies in the driver's seat of medical care. Oh, incidentally, I discovered something the other day about people who are listening might remember, if you're as old as I am, you remember a day that you could call up your doctor and talk to your doctor. Now, if you call up your doctor, that you can't even reach your doctor. You get somebody who says, okay, well, you can come in, you know, because the insurance companies want to force you to come into the office even when the doctor can deal with your issue over the phone. Well, entirely by accident, I discovered a way. There's only one good thing about COVID. The only good thing about COVID is that now you can talk to your doctor, because I mentioned to my doctor that I mentioned to the person answering the phone that I was nervous about coming into the medical facility because of medical facilities where people go in and out of are the best way to get COVID. And the attendant on the phone said, oh, well, if you're scared to come into the hospital, then we can set up a consultation with you. And so I had the first phone consultation that I've had with a doctor in the last 30 or 40 years just because I said I was nervous about coming into the medical establishment to get COVID. So just keep that in mind if you want to talk to the doctor. You can do it now. It's hard. You got to say the right things.
Well, at this point, Don, would you finish up? Because I'd like to open up the mics and have people respond.
Okay. Yeah. I'm just about done. Let me say one last thing. The research has come out just in the last few weeks that in 2020, for the first time since World War II, the life expectancy in the U.S. has gone down. It's gone down by 9 months for whites. It's gone down 23 months for Latinos and 33 months for blacks. And if you separated it by class, I'm sure it would be clear that life expectancy has gone up for the rich and gone down for the people who receive the fewest services from the U.S., from the medical establishment. And I know that there's people here who do not want to get vaccinated because they have a reasonable concern that the government does not look out for them. And I just want to say this, because I've talked to a lot of people on both sides of this. I've talked to physicians. And I want to say, if the government tells you, do not drive through a stop sign, that does not mean that you should drive through a stop sign. If the government says you should get your children vaccinated for polio, you should not ignore that and let your children get polio. And COVID is different because COVID, you can easily be a carrier of COVID and you say, okay, I don't need a vaccine because I'm not at high risk for COVID. But many of the people who get COVID don't know they have COVID, especially if they're young and healthy, and then they pass the COVID on to somebody else. And so I do not, you know, everything I've said is telling you that the capitalist government is totally untrustworthy with medical care. But be that as it may, I want to urge everybody to get vaccinated and wear a mask because I think that it's very, very important for us to do whatever we can to stop the spread of COVID.
Well, thank you so much for that, Don. And it is heartwarming to hear that the idea of a national health program is being accepted around the world. And your experience with Cuba, it will help us understand and support the Cuban struggle and possibly imitate that struggle.
I think they're going to try to destroy health systems around the world. I mean, American corporations for mining, you know, for processing metals, for running businesses, the U.S. tries to spread its model everywhere in the world. I think one of the many reasons the U.S. hates Cuba so much, of course, part of it is that they can't stand the idea that a country that has such a huge black population and has changed race relations so much, you know, would be there at the doorstep of America. But another is that Cuba has outshone the U.S. so much in medical care by having a national free healthcare system that is even better than Europe, that the that as a barrier to medical insurance companies and medical corporations expanding this horrible system throughout South America and Africa, which is what I think they want to do.
That's what they would like to do, but I think people are beginning to understand through the view of the Cuban people. And I am always happy to hear someone speak of Cuba, because it is a beacon of justice that we should all look toward, including health care and, most of all, education. Education. And this is what we tried to do on the program.
Ralph, I think it's really important for people to understand, when we're fighting for Medicare for all in the United States, we're not fighting just for people in the United States. We're fighting for people all over the world to defend whatever gains they have in medical care, because, like I said, they would like to destroy those gains everywhere. And so our fight in the U.S. is a worldwide fight.
And, yes, we must remember that. That's what Sister Lynn taught us, that what to do. Where do we do it? We join with people of like minds, and I hope tonight that we have joined people of like minds, Sister Betty.
Wow. We just want to thank everyone for their contribution. We want to apologize for the glitch. We were trying to do a recording of Lynn speaking when she first was freed from the death camp. But in the interest of time, if anybody would like to say a few words in terms of Brother Don Fitz's presentation, all of your mics are open. Yes?
Don't be shy. Well,
just
the mics are open.
Just would like to appreciate the comments of, you know, talking about the healthcare system in Cuba. Clearly, the United States has a lot to learn, both about access to education to be doctors, instead of making the ability to become a doctor something that typically only the very elite and rich can even offer to their children. So I think those are comments well taken. I also appreciate the comments about vaccination. There is deep distrust of the government that we cannot get around that. As someone who saw their mother jailed at the hands of the U.S. government, no one distrusts the U.S. government more than I. Having said that, it is a false equivalency to then say, and everything done in the name of public health is bad. And one of the ways Cuba has been successful is by enacting very rigorous public health initiatives. And public health initiatives are, we are doing X for the good of all public, which is part of, you know, having grown up, there's always so much noise when I'm talking, having grown up in a household where you do things for the good of the many, not the good of the one. And while I understand that people feel it is me, I don't want to get vaccinated, we have to understand that a nurse who is in an ICU and exposing themselves to people who will die if they get infected with COVID, that privilege of doing that is, it's not an inalienable right. It is, we are protecting the most vulnerable, which are patients who come into hospitals. And by not insisting on a standard that respects that ability and that, you know, gift of being able to help and heal others, then we can't do that as a society. We have to protect vulnerable people. And it is one of those areas where it's like, you know, especially as a socialist communist, we can't pick and choose the places we want to stand as an individual and want to say, no, we have to do what's right for people. The only other couple points I did want to share in terms of healthcare, one is that the insurance companies don't want you to go to your doctor. They have to pay every time you go to your doctor. So they would love nothing other than for the doctor to just take the phone call, because they have not traditionally paid for that. One of the things that did change with the CARES Act and COVID is that now providers can get reimbursed for just talking to you. And it was a way, it is one of those areas where you know, COVID has brought about changes that make healthcare more accessible. The last thing for the readers, and we don't have enough time, and maybe we'll do, you know, in the future, you know, a session on sort of healthcare, is, you know, Medicare for All is complicated to say. Because for those of you who have straight Medicare, you will recall that Medicare does not cover everything. Medicare does not cover your prescription unless you add an additional Part D benefit. Medicare does not cover 100% your hospitalization. You're on the hook for 20% of it. So when people say Medicare for All, I think we want to change our nomenclature politically to say we want universal health care. We want everybody to have the right to have health care for free in this country. But that is not Medicare. Medicare is a different way of paying for things. So I do think that, you know, we are going to have some discipline around, you know, saying what it is exactly we are advocating for in healthcare.
Okay, well, thank you so much for that, Dr. Zenobia Brown. And as you had said, we must get into this at other programs because we have run out of time. Thank you, all of you who participated and hung in there with us, and we will educate, entertain, and educate, organize, and be active next week. Thanks again, and good night.